This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
There we are. Good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month. Welcome. This is the Dirtbag, Glenn Andreessen, here beside you now until 12 noon. With me in the studio is my guest, Jim Gilbert of One Green World Nursery. Full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program. Jim, welcome.
Good morning, Glenn.
It's been an unusual spring, as usual.
As usual, unusual spring. Yeah, you know what I was doing yesterday? I was out pruning kiwis, trying to, because they're going so wild. My hardy kiwis are loaded with fruit.
Now, when you say you're pruning, are you thinning as well as pruning, or do you
mainly
thin?
mainly just pruning because they're all attempting to marry each other. The males and the females are just going wild and intertwining, and I'm trying to like, hold it, guys, you know, let's stay a little apart here, you know.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, for our purposes, we use them for cuttings, too. So if they get all mixed up, then they're not useful anymore, and we just have to cut the whole darn thing apart. So,
I see. You know. Okay. Yeah. Well, rundown for the show today, our plant of the month, brought to you by Jim, the honeyberry. Talk about that. We also will have a discussion of irrigation for the home garden and beyond, we'll say. A talk about what's at hand, what tasks are at hand in the June garden, what I've been doing, what Jim's been doing. And if we have time, a look at what's going on in the honeybee colony. This is a great month to be a beekeeper because the tasks are relatively easy. It's just adding more boxes when they need it. The work really begins next month. And I'll give you an update on our queen bee breeding program, too. So, no events to talk about that we know about. I've got a couple things coming up, but one at Garden Fever here this Saturday. It's a free event on fall gardening. Hmm. How about that, getting ready for fall gardening?
I'm not ready to think about fall yet, Glenn.
Well, that's part of gardening here, is you got to do the tasks at when they need to be done, whether you feel like it or not.
Sometimes I just want to be the grasshopper.
Yes, you know? Grasshopper.
Yeah, you know, just go out and enjoy the sunshine, and you know. But you're right, absolutely right.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Yep. Always thinking ahead.
Well, I forgot also part of our rundown for the day. We've got the garden stumper at the half past the hour, roughly, And we've got several questions that we will pass along for that. And we will also repeat, maybe we'll even repeat that now, the question from last month that we ran out of time before we had an answer. And once again, we are fortunate to be able to offer to you three pairs of tickets to the next showing of the Hollywood Theater's Eco Film Festival series. And that next showing happens to be tonight. So
how timely.
Yes. So if you're free tonight and you get the right answer here, we've got three pairs of tickets to give away to that. And you do that by calling this number, 503-231-8187. And our first repeat from last month, Jim.
Okay. This was appropriate, more appropriate last month because the plant was actually blooming. But for all of those of you who have pawpaws, I'm sure you'll call in with the answer to this. First, we wanted to know what the color of the pawpaw flower is. And secondly, how was it pollinated?
Okay. So if you know the answer to both of those or either of those, now how are we going to do this here? Well, that's okay. If we get two answers for this, they get the two pairs of tickets. And then we have one pair of tickets left for the last one.
Well, I always sort of thought that, well, okay.
You want to give it, that's a, your question is that they got to get both.
They have to both. I think they have to do both.
Very good.
Yeah.
They should know both. All right.
Yeah.
Pawpaw, what color is the bloom and what pollinates it?
Correct.
503-231-8187. And if you have any questions, gardening questions in general, please give us a call at that same number, 503-231-8187. Let's talk honeyberries.
Honeyberries are a very, very cool plant. And interestingly, our listeners and many people in North America are not familiar with this plant. And so you're hearing about it today, some of you probably for the very first time. What is a honeyberry? You
know, mm-hmm.
I'm not going to give away a couple things because we're actually going to have a garden stumper question about the honeyberry. But it is a very popular plant in its native range, which is northern Japan, eastern Russia, even into China, where people consume it just like we would huckleberries. And you go to markets, farmers markets, it's there in a little container, just like we go and buy blueberries or huckleberries, same thing. And if you happen to go to Sapporo, Japan, you can look for honeyberry juice. There's quite an industry around it. They've grown it there for quite a while. Jam, juice, all sorts of products sold in stores. In Russia, it's not quite so commercially produced, but it's more a home garden plant there, and also Siberia. I mean, it's very, very hardy plant. It grows down to minus 40.
Goodness.
It's a real attractive shrub. There are different forms of it. Some that only get maybe 2 or 3 feet tall, very spreading, with kind of velvety-like foliage. There's one called Blue Velvet, another one Blue Moon. Those are that form. There are some ones that grow tall. I've got a couple at home that are probably 8 feet tall.
Hmm. And what's the? You said it's bushy.
It's pretty bushy.
So it doesn't need a trellis necessarily.
It does not need a trellis. It's very happy on its own.
Okay.
And there are two categories which we've discovered over the years that, and it's important for people in Northwest to understand this if you want to plant honeyberries. One we call early blooming and the other is late blooming. The ones that grow in northern Japan and along the Far East Russian coast are typically late blooming types, and they are better suited to our climate because the later blooming allows more insects, primarily honeybees and bumblebees, to do the pollinating for them. The early ones come out so early that there aren't any insects around to do that job. So the early blooming ones are great for colder climates where spring starts later than it does here. But for us, the late blooming ones are best.
Do we need more than one variety for cross-pollination purposes?
Yes, we need two. We need two, at least two varieties, two separate varieties
so
for cross-pollination.
Very similar to blueberries in that respect.
Yes, but not similar to blueberries is the fact that honeyberries are perfectly happy on normal soil. They don't need acidic soil.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What's the flavor of the berry?
Well, I think it's not unlike a blueberry or a huckleberry. Some are more tart, some are sweeter, some are quite tasty.
what do you mean some are quite tasty? Others aren't?
Well, some aren't. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's funny. My Russian friends, some of the older Russian varieties have a bitterness to them, and my Russian friends value that. And I think, you know, that's really interesting taste, you know, because I don't value it myself.
Do they eat them fresh?
Yeah, sure.
These bitter or tart ones?
Somewhat bitter, yeah. I mean, they're not like repulsively bitter, yeah, but they're right. Definitely have bitterness to them. But that's not the types that we've been offering and growing because I personally like the sweeter ones.
Sure. You know? Well, yeah. I imagine most people do too.
Right. But it's an easy plant to grow. There are no pest problems. The only thing you got to be a little careful of, which is not too difficult to deal with, are birds. Birds love them. Cedar mm-hmm. waxwings are just going wild. I mean, they've already consumed a lot of ours. But what we normally do, we leave some for the birds, and then we cover the rest with netting. And it's really easy. Bird netting, you know, just sort of drape it mm-hmm. over, kind of fix it along the sides. And we frustrate the birds, but we get the fruit.
And when is the – it's fruiting now, I'm presuming.
It fruits along with strawberries.
Okay.
Ripens very early.
You said it needs or can tolerate or grows fine in just regular soil. Doesn't need a necessarily acidic soil.
That's right.
What are the sun requirements?
Well, we grow it in full sun. It's happy in half-day sun, and some people consider it to be even tolerant of more shade than that. Uh-huh. But our plants are out in at least half-day sun, and they're doing just fine.
It needs pollinators, which requires insect pollination, then full partial to full sun, normal...
Normal soil, watering, just like you would a normal plant, normal watering. You know, I could do a segue on watering, but for other things too.
We'll get there, I guess.
Yeah.
But pests?
Really none. Like
except birds.
Birds. Birds love them. And if you want to feed your birds something, you know, they'd be very happy to chew on these.
Well, that's a good way to attract then these native birds too.
Yeah, also interesting, like I think I mentioned, was that bumblebees are primary pollinators, and which is a little, you know, honeybees do it too, but mm-hmm. but I've noticed that even in the native range, bumblebees are the ones that are, you know, I love bumblebees. It's funny, nice sound, you know, and mm-hmm. you can really tell them apart, you know.
Well, that's similar to blueberries too. That bumblebees readily visit them. Honeybees, they're The bell-shaped blossom of the blueberry is just a little too long to make it real comfortable for the bee's proboscis, its tongue, to reach the nectar at the bottom of the bell. Oh. Whereas the bumblebees have a relatively longer proboscis can do it. But, and bumblebees are much more efficient pollinators for that reason. But you have a nest of 200 bumblebees, that doesn't compare to 30,000 to 40,000 honeybees. So they get the job done.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I've often wondered, I think you can actually get bumblebees. You can purchase them, can't you?
Well, yes, and you can rent them too, or some farmers do, mostly for greenhouse pollination because they're very expensive. It's hard to keep bumblebees. Uh-huh. It's relatively easy to keep honeybees, but bumblebees are a much different game.
Yeah.
An animal.
Yeah.
And are very good, and particularly for tomatoes or greenhouse tomatoes, hothouse tomatoes. A lot of bumblebee pollination is used into.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Okay, that's the honeyberry, and we'll have some questions on that with the garden stumper to give you a little bit more ideas on that.
You know, I could give a Latin name, and then we won't give away the garden stumper.
Okay.
If somebody, I know the botanists in the audience will catch this right quickly, but.
Okay, sure, I'm up for it.
Lonicera cerulea.
Okay. Boy, isn't that a good hint?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines here. Good morning, Carl. You're with the Dirtbag.
What is a kiwi?
It's a strange Australian bird that has lovely plumage. No, I think we're talking about the plant, are we not? The kiwi?
Well, whatever you started off talking about.
Yeah,
what
kiwi.
What the hell is it?
Okay. Jim?
Well, that's a really good question. Kiwis are available in stores, the typical fuzzy kiwi, brown fruit. It's very popular over about the last 30 years, and it's native. That particular fruit is native to China. It grows on a vine, a very vigorous vine, with really actually very attractive vine, beautiful foliage.
It's a perennial.
It's absolutely a perennial. It's a woody vine.
It's somewhat similar in appearance to grapes. The vine.
Yeah.
And the habitat.
I don't think I've ever seen one.
They're around. Where would be a good place to see one? Bishop's Close, Lake Oswego. I can't give you the address. It's on Military Road. They've got a beautiful park garden there, and there's some fuzzy kiwis growing on some arbor there.
I haven't been to this location that I'll mention in several years now, but there's one at a community garden, or used to be one at the community garden, the Brentwood Darlington Community Garden, at about the intersection of 57th and Southeast Cooper.
Okay.
So that's the kiwi. Yeah. And there's a couple of types of kiwi. You're talking about the fuzzy kiwi, and then we also have the hardy kiwi.
And the Arctic beauty kiwi.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a whole neat family of plants. Actinidia. Right.
Okay, well, let that be a lesson to us, Jim.
Yeah. Kiwis.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Well, kiwis were what really got me, was one of the first really interesting fruiting plants that we started growing in large quantities back in the 80s when it was pretty new.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with them? You eat them?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the fuzzy kiwi, usually most people will take the skin off, the fuzzy part off, and then slice it up and eat it or put it in salads.
The inside is dark to light green with some, I don't know, immature seeds, would we say that?
Well, they're mature seeds, yeah.
Oh, they're mature seeds, but they're black seeds. You just eat them. They're real small, and like sesame seeds.
Right. And the hardy kiwi is a smaller fruit. The fuzzy kiwi is like a big egg. The hardy kiwi is smaller, size of your thumb, with no fuzz. And you eat it like a grape. Just eat the whole thing.
And I prefer those to the...
They're sweeter.
To the fuzzy. Yeah.
Really good.
Just easier to eat, prepare and eat, too. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thank you. Okay, we still have more calls to deal with. Good morning, Tony. You got the answer to the garden stumper?
I think I do.
Great.
Flower, right?
The pawpaw, color of the flower, and what pollinates it?
Right. Well, it's kind of meat colored, kind of a pinkish maroon. And I believe what pollinates it are flies, beetles.
That's,
yep, you got it.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay, so if you want to give your, stay on the line and give your name and number to Kurt, he'll take it off the air, and you can... we'll put your name. Your name will be on the list for this showing, the film tonight, which I failed to mention. It's called Elemental at the Hollywood Theater.
Perfect.
Okay, great. So, Kurt, you'll get his information there. Let me just tell you about this film here. Elemental tells the story of three individuals united by their deep connection with nature and driven to confront some of the most pressing ecological challenges of our time. Just briefly, I'll tell you here. One is a young leader of a First Nation in Canada working to stop water pollution. Another, water conservationist in India, known as the Water Gandhi, working on reviving his country's most vital river, the Ganges, upon which more than 500 million people depend. And Jay Harmon, a naturalist, inventor, and entrepreneur whose inventions are based in the fast-growing biomimicry movement, which harnesses nature's principles to design things that will result in a more sustainable world. And after the film, a short panel featuring local experts and environmental organizations will follow. Featured panelists tonight, Travis Williams from Willamette Riverkeeper, Mary Hansel from Biomimicry Oregon, and Bob Salinger from Save West Hayden Island. So that's tonight. There'll be more opportunities to win two more pairs of these tickets to the Elemental and we'll have that at about 11:30. Okay, Kurt, any more calls to take care of here? Nope, we've cleaned the rack there. Let's take our first musical break here. It's going to be a little different this time, rather than a theme on what we're talking about. The theme of all of these three that we'll hopefully get to is kind of moving from the city to the country, out into the country. So the first one is The Meters, and it's called Out in the Country. Thank you. Well, part of what we're doing here in the dirt bag is bringing the country to the city. But
yeah,
you country freak, is that, well, that's what they were calling you when you were doing your thing, you know, back in the 60s?
Yeah, 1967. I left Portland in May and moved to Hood River and started living in the country. And there were freaks and there were country freaks. And so the title of my book, whenever I write it, will probably be something to do with country freak.
All right. Well, I've got a soundtrack for you if you ever make it into a movie.
Okay. Great.
Well, we have reached the part of our gardening time, the year, where supplemental water is necessary. And we need it now. I mean, even though it's been, you know, we've had a little bit, we haven't had any rain in the last, you know, week or something, but the ground is pretty dry still.
We had a good rain there for a bit. I was really thankful for that one. But yeah, definitely.
But now it's dry again.
Yeah.
And in particular, if you have raised beds, you know, one of the nice things about raised beds is that they dry out quicker, so they warm up quicker. But the bad side of raised bed is that they dry up quicker.
And another really important thing that for people to think about is weeds. Because even though you may, weed, you know, no big deal. But those weeds pull moisture out of your soil and take it away from the plants. So, we're right now on a rigorous weed removal.
Yes.
Plan, you know.
Well, there's been a lot of, I would say, advances, or at least marketing of irrigation systems and techniques and devices, we might say. And I may not be hip on all of what's out there, because what I finally settled on was kind of my own home hybrid stuff, but I experimented with soaker hoses and drip emitters and T-tape and things like that, and all of those are still used and useful, but they just didn't exactly give me what I wanted for my need. What do you use mostly in your garden? I mean, you may not have a home garden, but
right. Well, we try every year.
You're pretty light on veggies.
Sadly, light on our own veggies.
Yeah.
But our entire all of our nursery outside is drip irrigation, and we use T-tape underneath mulch. So we put the water where the roots are of the plants we want to grow and conserve it by using the mulch on top. So,
well, let's first of all explain what T-tape is, and then give us your opinion. Is that an appropriate use for, you know, somebody that has two or three raised veggie beds?
Yeah. Well, T-tape itself,
why is it called T-tape?
You know, that's a good question.
Okay.
I think it's probably something to do with the way that it's a pretty thin plastic material that has a little has little holes.
It's kind of flat tape. Flat tubing.
Yeah, yeah. It's, of course, pooches up when you put water in it, but you can get it with different spacings of holes. It's just a simple, basically a tube with holes in it, and those holes could be spaced 8 inches apart, 12 inches apart, and
3 inches apart.
I don't think get that close.
Yeah.
I think they're. I think 8 is the closest it comes in, which is pretty close. And
yeah,
it'll spread. You know, and water gets a nice even. It's pretty even with that, and then you put a pressure regulator on the end. Fairly simple pressure regulator, and then you just put water in it, and it's cheap and it works.
Do you leave it out year round?
Yeah, we do. If it's covered up, if it gets uncovered, then it can degrade and eventually.
Yeah,
And it's not it's thin, so you can't make. You don't want to hoe it.
Or yeah,
you know, a little fancier material and more preps for like fruiting plants where you have some space between them. We use drip tubing with emitters inserted into it.
And is that underground or above ground?
That's typically, well, it's either. We use it both ways.
I know at the Home Orchard Society's Arboretum out there at Clackamas Community College, I haven't been there for 1 or 2 years, but the irrigation that was used there at that point was, it was up, elevated, 1 to 2 feet.
Uh-huh.
Well, what do you think? I like that idea, because then you can see, actually, if it's getting water. That's one of the drawbacks of these any of these that are underground, you know, your first indication that something's clogged up is a dead plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our sort of goal is for our permanent plantings is to have the above ground type, and it's a little bit more of an installation because you need to have posts and wire and something to hang the pipe on. But you can get little spaghetti tubing and if you have a small plant you want to direct the water to, you can actually direct it with spaghetti tubing to that plant, or just let it drip from the emitter onto the ground. I think the spaghetti tubing method is probably better because it gets the water closer to the ground.
Yes.
You know, the further it drips, the more evaporation is going to happen as it splashes.
And if it's windy.
Yeah, exactly.
And probably the simplest irrigation technique, well, as maybe we'll start at the very simplest, which might be hand watering, or living in the Midwest when you might get a nice downpour every couple of days, or thunder showers.
Not something we're going to get here too often.
No. So. You know, hand watering is kind of therapeutic and fun for about 15 minutes, you know, but it gets old in a hurry and I've got other things to do. And sometimes you move along pretty quickly and you don't give enough water for the water to, you know, have enough time for the water to soak in. It just, you know, fire hose effect there. It's running off before it gets soaked in.
Which is something that we should mention is that it is important to get it to, certainly for woody plants, to have a deep watering. Mm-hmm. You don't want to just like do it on the surface. I've seen potted plants where the roots have grown up.
Oh, really?
Because they've
turned around and come back.
Instead of going down, they go up because that's where the water is, because they're not getting water deeply enough to get the lower soil moist. So
yeah, we want to drive those roots chasing the water down. And so then when there is a drought or you go on vacation and miss a watering, you know, it's not the death knell for those plants. So, all right, hand watering. And then, you know, when I was growing up, gosh, we had all the impulse sprinklers and the back and forth, you know, which is, you know, pretty, you know, fine if you have a big field and you don't need to worry about the soil being compacted and whatnot. But for home gardens,
it's great for when you have your swimsuit on, too, you know, when you're a little kid running around.
What, little kid?
When I was a little kid, you know.
It's not limited to that.
But I suppose it's true.
And so really not very efficient. And, you know, back then when it was almost giving the water away.
Well,
it's different now.
Yeah, you know, if you imagine how much of that, I can't remember the exact percentages, but it's somewhere 50% or more of that water on a hot day is just going up in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So you're just wasting water, you're wasting energy. It's not an efficient way to get water on a plant.
So and it's hard on the soil too, really compacts it down there. So then I think maybe soaker hoses maybe hit the scene, and they were made oftentimes from recycled rubber tires or whatnot, and they were real porous, round.
Yeah.
And you just hook your hose up to it and turn it on, and it would ooze out. And sometimes it would shoot out little fine mists. And, you know, there's a place for those.
I think it's not bad for if you have plants really close together.
That are in a row or if you want to wind it around or something like that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's hard to use that because you have to stake it down to put it where you want it. So that was a little drawback on that. Then drip types of irrigation piping came out, tubing and whatnot, kind of expensive. I experimented with that. And they've made some great strides in that. They even have little spray things now where you can cover more ground. But it was tough if you're going to plant a whole bed, for example, of carrots. Not in rows, just broadcast, and a whole bed of those. You know, how could you envision drip working without these little spray nozzles that they now have? And so I kind of soured on that, but I experimented with it, and you know, they're great for hanging plants. You can run just tubings right up there, and have really micromanage the watering, which is great. What other types of irrigation are there? Is that
well, you know, the old. It's interesting that we don't use it here in America. At least not. I think it's in California. Some degree, it's flood irrigation. You know, basically, well, they just fill ditches full of water. They do that a lot in Central Asia, Uzbekistan, that part of the world. But yeah, that's that's not something we're going to do here. So I think you've covered it pretty well. I mean, there's
okay. Well, my irrigation system, and I've talked about this several times, I believe, through the years, that the Dirtbag is a series of holes, small holes, sewing needle size holes that I've drilled in white pipe, PVC pipe, every 3 inches that comes out as a sprinkle, not as a drip, but as a sprinkle. And I've got a valve at each bed that I can control the flow. If I didn't have that, the water would be shooting 15, 20 feet. But I can cut the pressure down and make it 18 inches. And it's very, very gentle on the soil. So I can transplant out something and water it right away. And I know that it's getting water, not waiting for it to kind of soak over after you turn on the drip or the soaker hose or something like that.
So you take you actually drill a very, very tiny hole every 3 inches in a piece of PVC pipe.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
But boy, is it efficient!
Yeah,
when if a stream of water is going towards onto the pathway, well, I can just slightly turn the pipe, or I can put a stick in the way so it doesn't shoot there, or I take a little bit of beeswax and just rub the hole, fill up the hole, and most of these pipes I use the same one in the same position every year. I've written on it, so I know now how did this go together here.
Do you make the holes in line, or do you space them?
I do left, center, right when I'm drilling it, just so it covers a little bit more ground. And what would really be ideal on this, so if there's any engineers have been thinking about this, if I could get the water to pulse out, then it would actually have a better coverage, rather than just going out 18 inches and dropping there. Still haven't come up with that, but it's certainly acceptable the way it is now. So, and this is important time now to keep your soil, moist, not wet, soppy. But these annual veggies, for one, go from seed to seed in 4 months, and anything that sets them back will really hurt the yield, the production, maybe even attract more pests and disease that way. So. Don't let it dry out.
Yeah, it's interesting. In our work, we find more problems from overwatering than underwatering. People will call and have problems with their plants, and it's typically from putting too much. I mean, my first question is, what's your watering regime? And some people say, I put some on every day, it's really, for woody plants in particular, a deep watering once a week is really all they should require. And if it's a bare root plant you've put in the ground and it's still dormant, once it's watered in, don't water it for a while. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need anything because it knows no leaves to transpire. Potted plants, if you put a potted plant in the ground this time of year, really important first to loosen up the roots a little so they and spread them out in the planting hole, and then make sure the water goes put some water at the actual where the original pot. Is this potting soil, not just around, because the plant can actually dry out in the center, even though you think the soil is moist surrounding it.
I've heard it suggested that before you plant a potted plant to take it out of its pot and then put it in a 5 gallon bucket full of water and let it sit for 24 hours, just so it'll soak up so much, all the water that it can.
Well, it could hurt.
Because oftentimes they're just bone dry.
Yeah. They definitely want to be wet when they go in the ground.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing that's a real difficult thing to deal with is grass. And plants suffer immensely if you're trying to grow something in a lawn where you've got grass growing right up to the base of it. That grass pulls out so much of that moisture that it's very hard for it to get down to the roots of the plant. So, we recommend removing at least a 2 foot diameter circle around the base of the plant and keep it free of grass.
That also, just to wrap up our irrigation here, that's just an excellent point there, is give your plants all the advantage.
Yeah.
Don't let weeds usurp that.
That's right. The weeds will do just fine. There's plenty of them around.
You don't need to feel guilty about that.
That's
so.
Right.
All right. We'll take our second musical break here. Make sure Kurt's on board here. He is here. This is Taj Mahal called Going Up to the Country, Paint My Mailbox Blue. Taj Mahal.
I'm going to move up to the canyons, babe. I'm going to paint. put some flowers on it, mama. Yes, paint some trailing vines and do. I'm leaving L.A., mama. You know that smog have got me down. I'm leaving L.A., mama. Woman, now you know that smog have got me down. Yes, I'm moving to the canyon where there ain't nobody else around. Come here, baby. Mama, let me take you by your hand. Come here, baby. Mama, let daddy take you by.
Taj Mahal going up to the country. Paint my mailbox blue. Jim, you know what time it is.
It is garden stuffer time.
That's right. Okay, coming back to our plant of the month, honeyberries. Got two questions related to this, and all we need is just one answer. All we want is one answer from a caller, because we have two pairs of tickets to give away to the Hollywood Theater's Portland Eco Film Festival for tonight's showing. It's called Elemental, 7 o'clock, the Hollywood Theater in Hollywood. So the question is, honeyberries are members of what vining family? It's kind of surprising because mm-hmm. they're not a vine.
They're not a vine. They're a bush.
So that's one question. The second question is, what color are honeyberries? What color are honeyberries? Okay, so if you know the answer to either of those, not both, either, 503-231-8187. Meanwhile, we'll go to the phones and talk to John. Good morning.
Hi there. I wanted to talk about irrigation a little bit.
Okay.
Actually, it's kind of more than just irrigation, because it's also fertility and irrigation at the same time, you might say. Have either of you read Ruth Stout's book, The No-Work Garden Method?
I have.
So I've tried to use her method somewhat, not having access to as much compost as she, or mulch.
Mulch, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she used a lot of salt straw. Or
yeah, and she was patient. But in about 5 years, the ground became so fertile that she just had really no need to water, even in a drought year, she said.
And let's review here. Was she in Vermont or someplace New England?
Somewhere in New England, mm-hmm. I forget.
Okay, now. Different climate, so we need to factor that in.
Mm-hmm. But I've added a thing that I think. Well, I didn't invent it, but I've observed it, so I took it up, but I think it's a really good tip. I was rafting down the Deschutes one time a long time ago, and I saw these, like, 3 or 4 inch diameter drain pipes with the holes in them planted next to the trees that they had planted along this bank, and they had a sign, please water us. And, and that was a raft takeout spot where people were generally pulling up with a bunch of water in their boats, or anyway, they had bailing buckets back then quite a bit. People still do, but
yeah.
But so it was really convenient for the rafters to work together with the tree planting spot and dump water into these tubes. So I came home and started using that over the years, and I really enjoy that method of watering, because, like say, if you're in really thick soil and you're trying to plant a tree and you want to make it quick, you could plant the tree and right close to the tree, put a tube and a little bit of gravel around so that it'll hold a little more water than just the tube itself if you were planting in, like, say, thick soil that doesn't hold much.
Yeah, what
so
a good...
It really works good for planting trees, and I think it would work good for... I've used it in gardening, too.
Yeah, well, that's a good suggestion.
I like it. It's a quick low-tech system.
Yeah, and I like your story. Appreciate the story of the watering from the along
nice,
the Deschutes. Yeah.
What's the diameter of the tube?
3 to 4 inches. Mm-hmm. They're real commonly used in, you know, running off, say, a
perforated drain
water
pipe
off of a roof.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Probably wouldn't even need to be that big for around a tree.
Around a big tree, it's good, but...
well, a big tree, you probably don't need it.
I've used smaller diameter things around the gardens. I also invented a way to use a wine bottle to drip slowly onto either house plants or some potted plant outside or even in the ground. And you can adjust the speed of the drip, so you could use a gallon wine bottle or whatever size. So do you want to hear the method, how
make
to turn
it,
a wine bottle into a dripper?
Make it quick.
Yeah. You find the right size plumbing gasket from a faucet that fits in there with a hole in the middle. You put parachute cord with a knot inside, and that drips slowly. If you notch the gasket with a knife and make a little notch in it so that air can go in while water comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just put that in a... I always thought of putting it in a bamboo tube that was soaked in epoxy so that bamboo would last a long time, and you'd have a pretty blue or green, whatever color, wine bottle and a pretty bamboo.
Huh.
Anyway.
I see Portland Market in your future.
Well, I came up with that 20 years ago and haven't done anything with it.
Okay. We know how that goes.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's great. Thanks for the call, and thanks for the ideas. Okay. Boris. Good morning, Boris. You're with the Dirtbag.
Yes, two questions. One about growing garden plants from my own seed, and then also about beneficial bugs.
Okay.
I tried to grow some cantaloupe plants this year from seeds I'd saved from the previous season, and planted them in small containers. They took off, grew like weeds for a couple of weeks, and I left for a while, had somebody water them while I was gone, came back, and three of them were dead. One survived, but it's not doing very well. Of the three that were dead, I pulled them out, and they had looked like they had established almost no root ball, just very, very minimal roots, even though they grew like crazy to begin with. I was wondering what could have caused that.
I think Jim and I are looking at each other with the same answer, or the same idea here.
Who watered how much?
Or who didn't, right.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Could overwatering cause that?
Or underwatering.
Why would the roots disappear? I mean, if they were growing like crazy to begin with, it seems like the roots just disappeared.
They get too wet, they could rot, and you wouldn't see any sign of the root, and it'd just be what's the rest of the stem. The larger roots might still be there, but the fine roots that would create the root ball would just be gone.
And these were inside still or outside?
They were outside.
Yeah.
That'd be my first guess.
Yeah.
Usually if it was underwatered, you'd probably have the roots. It just would be, they'd just be dry.
When you said they grew like weeds, how big were they?
They were all probably 7-8 inches long and starting to branch out. It was a cantaloupe plant, and they started looking like they were getting ready to, you know, kind of collapse down onto the ground like they do.
Yeah, fall over type thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah,
well,
they looked fine. I really was expecting to have quite a good cantaloupe crop this year, and I've got almost nothing now.
Well, that... can't leave home.
There's lessons to be learned.
Yeah, and it's too bad, too, because, you know, we can never definitively say. So, yeah, second question about the beneficials. Sure. What's the question?
Do you know of any place on the west side of Portland to get praying mantis larvae?
I don't, but I don't recommend it.
You don't?
Nope. I would suggest planting or buying plants that are known beneficial insect attracting plants?
Well, I've already done that. I've done the marigold thing, and it did.
Marigold's not one that I'm referring to.
Oh.
It'd be cosmos, alyssum, echinacea, even sunflowers, ceanothus. I mean, there's many plants, and you can do a search for beneficial insect attracting plants, but marigolds are not one of the top ones.
I'm not trying to attract insects. I'm trying to keep away moths that just devastate my broccoli plants.
Well, if you plant these beneficial insect attracting plants, you'll be offering up nectar, which will help attract the insects that will either lay their eggs and in these moths. I'm assuming what you're talking about are the imported cabbage moth, the white moth that flits hither and yon.
Yes.
And wasps, the big wasps, and this includes yellow jackets, mud daubers, paper wasps, they enjoy, that's not the right word. They need to harvest things like that to feed to their young as a protein source.
Mm-hmm.
And while marigolds aren't going to keep any pests out.
Well, it seemed to help a little bit, but there's a few that come and lay their eggs, and you know the worms come and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how many plants you have, but you can go out there and do just hand patrol.
Yeah, I do that too. But
it's very easy to take the eggs off.
Yep.
Just flick them, you know, just rub them off with your thumb. That's easy. And if you only have a half dozen plants, you know, do it.
Yeah.
It's quite effective for the beneficials.
Yeah, I just can't seem to find all of them. They're good at hiding the eggs, and I go out and they completely strip one plant, has absolutely no leaves on it at all.
Yeah. Look for the telltale sign of frass. And those big, if you see any frass or if you see any holes at all, then you know that there's a little tiny green larva there. Look for it.
I don't know what frass is.
Well, frass is the poop left behind. It's kind of little dark green or black balls.
Okay, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Right. If you don't see that and your plant is being decimated, look for slug slime.
Yeah, no.
That would be the other likely culprit here.
And why is it that you don't recommend praying mantis?
Well, for one, they're not native, so it's not sustainable to have them in your garden. And for two, they're really just general feeders in the garden. They'll eat good insects and bad.
I see.
But they're fascinating insects.
Yeah, I love them.
But, I mean, so that's a reason to do it, but don't expect to have great insect control with that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's just a myth.
All right.
I mean, that's a science thingy, you know. So, but good questions.
Thank you.
You bet.
And before we go on, I was once thinking about leaf consumption. And something just reminded me that this is the time of year to start watching your gooseberries for the currant worm, which will eat the leaves of the gooseberry, and you will see your gooseberry leaves disappear. Because the worm is exactly the same color as the leaf, you have to you have to look kind of closely, and they're easy to take off and just remove them by hand. But it's amazing the damage they'll do. They just devour the leaves.
Huh. But not the fruit.
Not the fruit. But the fruit doesn't do very well when
right.
there's no leaves
without
left.
Any energy gathering there. So
right.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Good morning, David. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hello. Yes, honeyberries.
Yes, the garden stumper.
Yes, those are in the genus Lonicera, which is honeysuckle.
That's right. That's the only one we need from you now. Don't give any more hints there, because we're going to have one more question there. So if you give your name and number to Kurt, we'll make sure your name's on the list for the screening of this show tonight.
All right, appreciate it.
Great, thank you. Yes, honeysuckle. Who would have thunk?
It's amazing. We have honeysuckle vines at our place, and they're incredibly fragrant and spectacular flowers. And honeyberry, honeysuckle, it doesn't look anything like it.
Does it have a fragrance? The honeyberry?
Not really. Not noticeable. I love taxonomy. You know, the people who named plants and decided they were related to each other. It's fascinating.
I mean, and they did such a great job.
I know.
Imaginative.
I know. And you can, and then the whole idea of grafting, where you can take a stick from one of that same family and put it on another. You know, like put a pear, quince on pear, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how did they figure that out?
Trial and error?
That's amazing.
I have a confession to make in the garden this year concerning my grafting. For many years, I've been using one of my apple trees that sends up a fair number of suckers from the root stock. And when they get a certain size, I don't even have to dig down there. I can just pull it out, and it comes out with roots on it. Mm-hmm. And I can use that for my root stock.
Right.
And I've been doing that successfully for quite a few years off this one plant. And so I did that again this year. And it was larger rootstock, which was okay because I had a larger piece of scion piece to graft on there. So I did, and you know, just really not much was happening at all. All my other grafts were looking good, you know, and this one, not much happening. And then some growth started coming out of the base of this, the rootstock that I was using. It was a maple tree.
Oh no.
So I had a seedling maple growing right next to my rootstock.
That's great. Oh. And those taxonomists were so smart to
and
say,
it didn't work.
That's not going to work, Glenn. Right.
Oh, well, yeah. I can laugh about it now.
Yeah.
Okay, we have one more. We have another caller here. Michael, do we need to, is this have to do with the garden stumper? Okay, so we're looking for the color now of the honeyberry. All right, Michael, you're on.
Honeyberries are blue.
That's right.
That's right.
Who would have thunk that from the name there? So, Michael, the same song and dance. Here's Kurt to take your information there. So thanks for coming.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
And since we're talking about the color of the fruit, we should also mention that the juice is the darkest juice of just about any fruit I've ever seen. It's like ink. I've not seen studies, but I'm sure it must be really high in antioxidants from the honeyberry. It's incredible how dark the juice is. It makes very nice juice. We give it out as samples at our fruit harvest festivals, and boy, it's amazing.
I'm not having any until it comes in gelato form.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have some of that for you too.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about the what's going on in the honeybee colony here. Kurt lost me here. He's not back yet. So we'll talk about what's going on here. And like I was saying earlier there, there's just a lot of bees that are being raised in the colony now, but there's a lot of workforce bees too, the field bees, as we're saying. So we're seeing a lot of them out there, and they're bringing in a lot of nectar now. Now this cold, you know, cooler, rainier weather that we're expecting now for the next maybe week here is going to put a damper on it, and I'll tell you how that can affect it here. We've got the one colony that I have is on a scale, an old warehouse platform scale that, you know, you have the counterweights you put on, then slide the counter dial there. And just today I had to add the 200-pound weight to the colony. So this colony is over 200 pounds. That doesn't mean it weighs that it has 200 pounds of honey. You know, because I have boxes and bees in there.
Does that weight bees too?
That's everything.
Yeah,
it just weighs everything. So what I can measure is the change from the daily change.
How much of the weight do you think is the bees? I mean, in proportion to the honey.
Oh, well, you know, there's wooden boxes and you know other things.
Right.
So the bees may weigh just no more than 20 pounds. Bees.
Do they weigh that when they're flying or only when they're sitting?
Well, they would weigh the same no matter where they are.
That's an interesting thing, though, isn't it?
Right. But they're not flying inside the colony there, are they? No, there's no room there. Right? But you're right. I mean, they would be less if they were flying on the scale.
So you'd want to weigh them at night.
Well, it doesn't matter when I weigh them as long as it's consistent.
That's right.
Right. So I weigh them every morning.
Yeah.
And I don't have the exact dates, but I'm going to say in mid-May, they weighed about 190. This colony weighed 190 pounds. And 2 weeks later, they weighed about 180. They had lost 10 pounds because that was a rainy stretch there. So they were eating the stores that they had. Uh-huh. They were not able to replenish the honey supply. And then, just about a week ago, it was back up to 190. And now it's putting on pretty consistently, I mean, these nicer days, 2 to 3.5 pounds, somewhere in that range. I've had them put on as much as 8 pounds, 8 to 10 pounds in 1 year. And this is not my biggest colony either. a bigger one would put on more, I'm quite sure. But it gives us an idea of what's blooming or how many things are blooming now. So really what the beekeeper does is just make sure they have enough room to put the excess storage honey. Mm-hmm. So, all right, Kurt, let's just get a little bit of this last piece here. This is Steve Miller from a live version of Going to the Country. Going to the country. Well, we're bringing this country back to the city. That's part of this. All right, Jimmy had one more thing to say about irrigation.
Well, yeah, you know, when you were talking about weight of the hive, it made me think about an experiment we're doing. And there's two words that are involved with this experiment. One is volumetric or gravimetric. Ones I learned just recently. Gravimetric means basically measuring by weight. And so we found a scale. It's a home scale. Sadly, I haven't found this on a commercial level specifically for plants, but it's a home scale that broadcasts a Wi-Fi signal. So, and it's high tech, you know, so you can watch your weight, you can share it with your friends, all this stuff.
So it's a scale. It's just a scale.
On a scale. But what we're experimenting with is using this to determine when to water plants. So if you fill your pot with water to where it's fully watered, you put it on the scale, and now it's going to start losing water as the plant transpires and so forth. And at some point, it will become dry. And you want to determine where that point is, and then you can read that on your iPhone, for example, and decide when the proper time is to water rather than just guessing, as sometimes we have to do.
Seems like they would be able to sell that with an automatic watering thing.
I hope somebody, you know, I mean, it's a really interesting idea, and I'm looking forward to being developed for that purpose. But
you keep us informed on that.
I will definitely do.
We'll be back in a month. Well, 4 weeks this time. I didn't write down. Oh, it is July 10th. And as usual, we'll be recording a show for pre-record our show for the August time because I will be out of town as usual. In August there. So we'll try to...
Tell us where you're going in August next time. When you're,
yes, I will. Yeah, back to my roots.
Yeah. Okay.
Jim, thank you very much for coming.
It's been fun.
Kurt, as usual, marvelous job. This is Glenn Andreessen. Thanks for listening. Now I'm a farmer.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503 232 HOPS, or hopworksbeer.com. This program was also brought to you by a grant from One Green World, a nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. Now located in Portland at 6469 Southeast 134th Avenue. For a color catalog, the number is 1-877-353-4028 or online at onegreenworld.com. And finally, this program was also brought to you by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532